Morning, we recited in the morning service the Bodhisattva Metta Sutta. There's a Metta Sutta that's the old Pali version, and there's a slightly later version called the Bodhisattva version. They're all variants on the same teaching, and it starts out saying, "This is what should be done by one who walks the path of kindness and peace." Well, we're beginning a precept group, a precept study, and the precepts are just a way of embodying and giving some shape to, this is what should be done by one who walks the path of kindness and peace. In the Metta Sutta, it gives the general full heart of, let one be energetic and sincere and without pride. Well, those are, sounds like the precepts right there. And the great wish, may all beings be at ease. Well, how do we accomplish that? How do I cultivate an infinite goodwill toward the whole world, as the Metta Sutta says? And so one of the ways is through the precepts as an expression of, well, how do I go forward? What does it mean? Last week, I talked about the eyes of equality, the eyes of the big mind that sees the whole, and the eyes of discrimination that see the various details with which we... Discrimination should not be a bad word in that sense. To discriminate, to differentiate, the eyes of differentiation, perhaps. What we need in order to act well. So, but it's complicated. And so we have 10 precepts about behavior, and then they're complicated too. And the whole, but we have 10 great precepts that regard actions of our body and mind and speech. And the whole of the 10 great precepts can be contained in the basket of the first precept, which is, I vow not to take life. I vow to protect life. Of course, those are actually two different statements. I vow to protect life, and I vow not to take life. And before we get to what, how do you not take life, what is vow? We have to start with the, what is the vow? The whole of the Metta Sutta is a statement of vow. Vow is, so those of us who had no religious background at all thought vow was a weird word. And those who have a religious background from somewhere else either like the word or hate the word. It's, a, you know, it's one of those charged words. But it's wonderful. And I guess it was Katagiri Roshi who turned me on that score, because his life was a life of vow. Words like vow and faith were pretty difficult for me. Until the first time I met him, and he talked about faith in Buddhism as being spiritual self-confidence. And so vow is the vow to go forward. Faith is not some kind of a blind faith, and vow is not a blind vow. So the vow is a statement of aspiration, of intention. The beginning of the Buddha way as a way of practice is called bodhicitta, the awakening of the mind of enlightenment, or awakening of aspiration to wake up to reality, bodhicitta. And this aspiration to awaken sends us into zazen, and it's the same aspiration to awaken that sends us into a practice of precepts. It's the same aspiration to wake up and to live and act in accord with this, in a way that then will be a good way for yourself and others. So, this kind of vow or aspiration or deep intention, it's about walking in a direction. It's not about goals and expectations and success and failure. It's about walking in a direction, about finding your energy and committing it to a direction, putting your energy into that walking. Katagiri Roshi lived by vow. That doesn't mean he got it right. He didn't always. Sometimes he got it wrong spectacularly. More often he got it right pretty well, or even spectacularly. But to live in vow is not to be perfect. To live in vow is to say, I take my stand on aiming at going in this direction, and I'm willing to look and see where I fall away from that. And he was, by and large, willing. You might say, I vow to aim at seeing all of life as precious. Oh. How will I see life as, with these eyes, not with somebody else's eyes, not somebody else's view, somebody else's doctrine. How will I, with these eyes, see life as precious? How will I find my way to aim at that as constantly as I can? Wow, there's this great practice of Zazen for realizing how constantly we forget. It's one of the great things we learn in Zazen, is how much we forget and what to do next. Return. Wake up again. So Zazen, in that very bare bones aspect of Zazen, of being present, forgetting, and returning, to putting yourself and your energy to being present, is the heart of how to of the generating of this deep intention to practice, to wake up. Zazen is itself that kind of vow. That when you feel, then you have that moment where you say, gathering your energy to really return to being present, or not quite, and fading right back out into some other thought. That bit, that energy of focus, of intention that it takes to say, no, this is, here's where I want to be, not where my mind is playing its games. That is the vow. That's the energy of vow right there, of your intention. So we practice that and study that and explore that every time we sit down, and about a million times a day, when we're present enough to be aware of that. When Zazen gives you that time to be aware of that commitment over and over and over, marshaling your energy to live. We live by vow when we aim to wake up together and to put our energy into that aim. That's the spiritual life in Zen. It's not a doctrine, but it's very powerful. More powerful than a particular doctrine. And yet it needs some shape and some container. So we have this aspiration, an aspiration to see the whole body of life. That's, you might say, the aspiration of bodhicitta, of the awakening mind. To see with the eyes of equality, to see with what's called magnanimous mind, to see with the mind behind, the eyes of equality that see the shared nature of all beings, has a mind behind it that's called magnanimous mind. That's the mind that looks out of those eyes of equality and says, oh, all are included. We are all in this together. In fact, we are made of each other. This life is precious and it is not separate from my life. Even though it is distinct, we want boundaries. At the same time, it's not separate from my life. Its well-being is not apart from my well-being. And somehow, we have to apply this big mind and these eyes of equality in particular instance after instance, because life is one long mush, amalgam, entanglement, twisted vine of circumstance after circumstance. And you reach for the blackberry and you get caught on the thorns. Conditions, we have to take care, in order to take care of things in as large and encompassing and heartful a way as possible, we have to take care of them, of each particular situation. And then they're always changing. They won't hold still even. Always I will try to take care of things one at a time, but they won't hold still long enough for me to even figure out what's going on. It's very confusing. Last week I talked about choice. I said we have some choice, and we have choice in what we do. We have to make choices about how to go forward. So we have to discern the individual and the particular and see it as different from the next. Somehow with these eyes of equality, with this big mind, still to see the differences. And then to find a way to discern and choose what to do. Well, what kind of choice do we have? Do we have free will? Is this a world of determinism? Is that what karma says? It's very tricky. We arrive at this moment on the crest of a great wave, which we're rarely really aware of. Every moment we're arriving here on the crest of a great wave of circumstances, conditions, lives, deaths, births, choices made previously by ourselves and others, our parents' lives, our siblings' lives, lives of people we don't know, lives of and actions and events that we know and that we don't know, the huge, huge number of them, and they arise as this moment. We arrive here on this crest of this moment. And we have had some input back there somewhere, what I did yesterday and what I didn't do yesterday, and last year and last decade and last 30 years and 40 years, and choices we've made. They're part of it. Here I am, right here and now. Do I have... So, does that wave determine what happens next? Do I sit on this wave like a surfer and surf it freely? Well, even the surfer knows they're not free. They have such an image of freedom, aren't they? Surfers riding the waves. Well, boy, they're not free. They're really constrained by the dynamics of wave motion and action. And the movement of the water and the size of the wave and its trajectory and how the board hits the edge of the wave and their skill and their background and who else is out there and what they had for breakfast. All of this. And the last time they had a fight with their husband or wife about the fact that they were going surfing. All of this is there on that wave. And they choose. They say, I'm going to take this wave or I'm not going to take this wave. I'm going to surf this way. I'm going to surf the other way. I'm going to hit it with this edge of the board or that edge of the board. They chose a board to go out with in the first place, or to go out or not to go out. So there's some choice there. But it's not determined, but it's certainly not free of tremendous constraints of all that has gone into making this moment and all the circumstances acting in that moment. We're always surfing and falling in the water. So we do want to explore what kind of choice we have and what kind of choice we don't have. Neither free will nor determinism. We're informed, we're constrained, we're pushed, we are exploring, we're pushed from behind, and we're eager to move forward, or we resist moving forward and there's nothing behind us. All the circumstances feel so different. We're always in this kind of motion. But the element of choice is called volition. It's human volition. And it's often called by the name of karma. Much very potent and much misunderstood word. Because it means so many different things, too. So let's say that there is some personal will, right, that pulses through all of our actions and energizes them. I will go out surfing today. I will go to the Zendo today. I will take this wave. I won't take this wave. I will let go of my expectations about being a great surfer and just surf this wave. I will just sit zazen. I will commit this year to doing the precept. I will not do that. I will make some different choice. There is a personal will volition pulsing through all our actions and energizing them. And it's one of the characteristics of human life. In the Heart Sutra, the five skandhas, the five aspects or aggregates of a human life, one of them is volition. On what basis will you choose? There is an element of volition. How will you use it? How will you guard it? How will you? Where will you encourage it? And where will you restrain it? How will you be skillful with it? And how will you cultivate the having of energy with which to move? In the six perfections of the Bodhisattva path, one of them is energy, enthusiasm, commitment, because we have to gather the urge to move, to do something. It's a very important aspect of practice and of life. What guides you in putting your energy into one direction or another? Or, it's often put as, what are your values and how do you live them out? That same kind of question. When my wants and needs and fears, my personal ideas and feelings, based on my ideas of self-preservation in a hostile world, because I want to preserve myself, and maybe it's hostile, so maybe I'll better assume it is, because, oh, guess what it is? You know how that happens. When my personal wants and needs and a sense of myself operating as a lonely little individual in a strange sea of life, when that is uppermost, it tends to control and direct our thoughts and our actions and to further remove us, isolates us, and narrows our sphere, because all I can turn to then as a gauge is my own ideas about things and without an outer reference of any kind. That's the great suffering. That's the great suffering of living by karma, living in terms of what I think right now about my wants and fears and hopes and needs. You can sit on the Buddhist. You can sit on the Buddhist one. It's fine. Karma is the human acting on volition. And all of our actions have volition in them, beyond good or bad. But certainly potent, and potent energy that can turn into a very harmful direction. Or be just, humans are karmic beings. What will we do about that? Can we use that for our energy to move forward in our life, or will we be sort of swallowed up by that? That's really, in a way, the question that karma poses. And the category used to speak of living by vow or living by karma. I think that talks about it in his first book. To live by karma is to say, my way or the highway. What I want is it. That's not the same as being a karmic being, a being who has volition and a personal self and is trying to figure out the way forward. The person who knows themselves as a karmic being and says, I want to live for the well-being of myself and others as part of one whole, discerning for the good of the whole and the individual. In terms of this natural universe of change, where I can't hold on to anything, and where my life is made out of your life, Bob, I'm going to do that. That's called living by vow as a karmic being. So when we first heard that from Katagiri, we would say, oh, here's living by karma, oh, here's living by vow. Two different camps. But you live by vow as a karmic being. It's complicated, but it's very rich, very interesting. So I think we need to differentiate in our minds, in a sense, between living by karma, being sort of dragged around by our wants and wishes and desires, and being a karmic being with a vow or aspiration or intention, which then does not mean to ignore your wants or needs, but to understand them in a large context. Human volition and human desire are there in your hearts, wanting to live, to prosper, and for others to live and prosper, and to live and prosper with others, and to understand. There's a human volition in that. Otherwise, we couldn't do that. We live just by karma when we take our own ideas to be reality itself. That's how it happens that we wind up getting dragged around by our karma. No one sets out to say, oh, I want to be dragged around by the least common denominator I can find. No one sets out that way. Nobody. But when we don't understand how the mind works, the mind heart of thoughts and feelings as one mind, I guess. When we don't understand that our mind will forever set up a little picture of ideas of how things are and I'm at the center, and we believe that to be how it is, we believe that I'm isolated and alone, we believe that what I want is the only way things should be, and that there's a limited pie and you're out to take my piece of lemon meringue. When we believe that, that's suffering and delusion. That's living by karma. And so we do a practice, whether it's our practice of zazen and our practice of the precepts, to keep breaking that open. Because our mind will keep doing that. Our mind will keep creating images and pictures and say, oh yeah, that's how it is. That's reality. I look out, that's what I see, and forgetting that it's a map and a filter that we've put on. So we have to keep breaking that open. With zazen, with precepts, primarily with whatever those are shapes for the vow to keep breaking open the narrow closed mind. The vow to keep opening our life and going forward on what we see, when we see most widely. So it's the vow to see with the eyes of equality, with the big mind, and the eyes of differentiation or discrimination or discernment. Maybe that, the eyes of discernment that differentiate one thing from another so that I can be skillful. You can't be skillful in life for a minute if you don't differentiate between the ground and the pit, person and the zabaton. I don't want to treat Frederica like a zabaton. I want to know that's Frederica and that's the zabaton. Otherwise we all suffer. So I better refine those eyes of differentiation or discernment. With these eyes of equality, or with this big mind that says, the reason I want to do it is so that I can take best care of each as it really is. That's the big mind behind the mind that is differentiating all the time. So when I practice a precept of a vow not to kill, I want to discern specific details, what I'm doing that's killing, and what I can do that isn't killing. But I want to do it not with a squinty-eyed approach, not with a scorecard, but with this mind that says, how can I discern and differentiate killing and not killing as clearly as possible, with a mind that says, I do want to do this for the sake of taking the best care I can of each thing. It's Dogen's version of the precepts where it says, life as not killing nurtures the seeds of Buddhahood and of succeeding to the Buddha's life of wisdom. Do not cut off life. The going in the direction of not killing is seeing how I kill, seeing how I don't kill, seeing how we interact, you and I and all the other creatures, so that I can go with and generating an intention not to kill, because with the biggest mind I can generate, I see how we are in this together and how our good supports our good and how life supports life. But I'm going to do this with care, with a differentiating care. That's life as not killing. And this nurtures the seeds of Buddhahood. Do not cut off life. Do not cut off life, but we consume at every instant. Our life requires chewing up other creatures. One evening I was going home from the Zendo last week around Ferguson, and just before the stop sign, I saw a fox. I'm always on the lookout. I love the fox, the little gray foxes with their tawny sides. And this small fox had dinner in his mouth, dangling, four little legs dangling down. And he stopped. Being a fox, he didn't just run. He stopped and turned. He or she, so I say, stopped and turned and looked at me with dinner hanging down from his mouth and watched me. And of course, I stopped and watched it. And then it turned and went into the bushes. We're forever going through life with somebody else's legs dangling out of our mouth. And if you're a vegetarian, you've got somebody else's roots dangling out of your mouth. Different, but it's not completely different. We consume as our very life. All living things consume other life at every meal. Without that, we die. Life is made of death. So we constantly kill other beings inadvertently. So we can start to differentiate inadvertently. Squashing bugs and plants underfoot because I didn't see them as I walked by. Bacteria in our stomachs. Your life is made. You know, we're a rather large civilization in here, a colony of many, many beings. We kill unavoidably when we eat lunch. When we live in a house made of trees. When we print up the Bodhisattva Metta Sutra using paper, we're taking life of trees and of all the creatures that lived by the tree. So there is an inadvertent killing. This doesn't make sense to feel guilty for it. But we have to say, this is and this happens. I need to find a way to take it into account, to account for my life being made of other lives, for my life having a great deal of inadvertent killing. How will I do that? That's what the precept says. It says, please ask yourself this question. It doesn't spell out a particular formula. It says, please ask this question of yourself. How can I best, most specifically and most encompassingly, take care of the fact that I inadvertently kill just to sustain my life? Well, then that's, of course, not the only way I kill or you kill. Then there's a kind of indirect killing. It's not really... There's not a clear line between them, but what I would mean by indirect or maybe careless killing, you know, is I don't notice the killing that's involved in the plastic water bottle. The killing that went into creating it and the killing that happens if it finds its way out into this great gyre of plastic in the middle of the ocean. Or the killing of resources involved. So much is hidden from our view. We don't have to pay attention. Some of it we can't. And we don't see ourselves as wantonly killing. The second precept is, I vow not to take what is not given or not to steal. And someone said to me once, I don't steal. I hardly knew what to say. Because we are forever taking what is not given. You don't have to call it stealing. You can say taking what has not been offered into our hand. It happens all the time. When we pick a flower, we're taking what is not given. It happens at all times. It doesn't say we should be guilty. It says we should pay attention to this. So I kill sort of unconsciously, carelessly. Do I drive a little further than I need to drive? Do I buy new things before the old ones are used up? Do I waste food in the fridge? Okay, inadvertent killing is eating that carrot. Careless killing is not eating it, letting it go to waste. So it's not a very clear line between them. And those are not the only ways I kill. Well, you know, there's purposeful killing. You know, I was invaded by ants in my little cottage last winter. Mm-hmm. Deeply invaded. They were pouring out of the light sockets, the switchblade on the wall of the kitchen. Well, I got ant traps. I did. What was I going to do? Invite each one? And there were too many of them to invite them all outside. They just wanted to come back in anyway. I got ant traps. I'd like to have one of those little devices to pick up individual, anything that's big enough to pick up, like a spider or a large beetle or something. I'll pick up in my little plastic thing, look at it, and take it outside. But there's so many little ants to do that with. I purposely killed them. Pesticides, herbicides. Anger, hatred, war. Death penalty. The war in Iraq. Other wars. This is purposeful killing. And we need to take account of our participation. So we have to discern closely, and what I take that precept of not killing, I take it down to just that, not killing. Or a disciple of Buddha does not kill. Mostly I just say not killing. And I let that come up. Sometimes it comes up in my face like that. Sometimes I forget about it. Sometimes it's quietly there like a heartbeat. I let it come up. I want it to come up to remind me to pay attention. It's there to say, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. Take a high standard of attention and a high standard of contact, of action. Doesn't say what that standard is for you. And not killing to vowing not to kill. Vowing not to kill means, oh, I want to bring my big mind, as big as encompassing as I can, and my ability to differentiate one thing from another and put my energy into this and act on this. That's vow. Vow and vow about what? Not killing. Comes together. This is why I've come to feel that we live in a moral universe. Everything, every single action has the quality of, with what quality will you do it? With what mind, with what intention will you do this? And so everything, and that is the basis of the meaning of every action is a moral question, a moral issue. Question of your values and your intention. The clearest way for us to put it is our intention. Including to intend to have fun on a nice sunny afternoon. Intentions aren't all heavy. Intentions for the future, intentions for the present, intentions to learn, intentions to find peace and happiness for yourself and others. Intention. Intention to remember that we're doing this together. I'm done. Any comments? Mm-hmm. Comments, questions?
I have a comment about taking how gratitude is a way of, I mean, not killing, but the gratitude of what it is that's sustaining you and the acknowledgement that you are it and that it doesn't die in a certain level. It just changes form. That's
so,
a way of finding balance with that whole.
Yes,
dilemma.
Yes, as the gardener. So I'm taking something in, so I have to say, I am eating life, so what will I do with that? How will I do that? Mm. I'll do that with gratitude, mm. and I'll do it by not wasting that mm. energy of its life. So gratitude is an immense, mm. immensely positive way to meet that side of our life. Mm. Yeah.